Welcome to the KSTE Farm Hour. Here's KSTE's Farmer Fred, Fred Hoffman.
The campfire in Butte County continues to burn. It's now the largest, deadliest fire in California history. We update evacuation sites for livestock and household pets. Will Congress pass a farm bill before New Year's? We have an update. We highlight the ag commodities that will be highlighting your dinner table this coming Thursday. Yes, turkeys, sweet potatoes, cranberries. Yes, there are cranberries grown in California. More and more farmers are raising livestock, crops, and their grandchildren. We have a report on how they cope with that major task. All that, crop reports, and more on this week's KSTE Farm Hour. Let's get started. It's now the largest, deadliest fire in California history. The Camp Fire, so named because the location of the start of the fire back on November 8th was near the intersection of Pulga Road and Camp Creek Road in Butte County. That's in the Sierra Nevada foothills, not too far from the town of Paradise. And at press time, the fire had consumed over 140,000 acres, and it's still burning. Fatalities are mounting. There's still about 100 people missing. Over 15,000 structures are threatened by this fire. Residences and commercial structures destroyed total nearly 9,000. Some estimates put 90% of the town of Paradise as being destroyed. Authorities haven't yet compiled final figures on the damage to agricultural property, but one local ag-related business, Menden's Nursery in Paradise, has reportedly burned to the ground. Plant growers and ag suppliers who have worked with the nursery over the decades told us it's doubtful the aging owners of Menden's will rebuild.
Amidst high wildfire death tolls in California, USDA meteorologist Mark Bresberg has a simple message.
These are very quick-moving fires, and if you are told to evacuate, then you need to evacuate.
He says strong winds help the fires travel rapidly.
Sometimes these things can move, you know, 40, 50 miles an hour along with the wind. The fires bounce from treetop to treetop in certain situations, and it's upon you before you even know.
He reminds people that the best thing is to always be prepared.
This goes anywhere, anytime there's a fire situation or a weather emergency. Know what you have to do to take shelter, be it a tornado or a hurricane. If you get the warning, then act accordingly.
In emergencies, people should always pay attention to official warnings and have an away kit so they can go at a moment's notice. This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Evacuation centers for animals filled fast. Shelter for small animals has run out at the Del Oro Old County Hospital in Oroville. Small animals should now be taken to the Chico Municipal Airport. Large animals are being offered shelter at the Butte County Fairgrounds in Gridley. FFA chapters throughout Northern California have been rushing needed supplies for humans and animals to the Chico and Oroville areas outside of the burn area. The Butte County Farm Bureau and the Butte Ag Foundations have created a Camp Fire Animal Agricultural Assistance Fund. The fund will accept monetary donations dedicated to feeding, housing, and maintaining livestock displaced by the fire that are being cared for at the Butte County Fairgrounds. Find more information online at butteagfoundation.org.
Is there any weather relief in sight for wildfire-ravaged California?
We don't see rain moving into California for another week or so. It looks like the rest of the week is going to be dry.
That was USDA meteorologist Mark Bresberg, who says the fires have been fueled by Santa Ana winds.
Can't stress enough, obey the warnings to get out of the way of these fires because they're moving so quickly because of the high winds that are accompanying some of these fires.
There are fires in the south.
The largest is the Woolsey Fire in Ventura County. That's about 40% contained, but conditions are changing in Southern California a bit. They expect containment by November 18th.
Meanwhile, the deadly Camp Fire in the north has claimed the state's highest number of victims from a wildfire.
It's still only 35% contained, and according to the Forest Service, they don't expect full containment until November 30th.
This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The campfire has concerns for ag workers throughout the Sacramento Valley. The choking smoke from that fire has enveloped the valley, creating hazardous working conditions. Air quality indexes have measured the smoke in areas from Redding to Modesto in the unhealthy and very unhealthy range, and at times even in the hazardous zone. Very unhealthy is when air quality index numbers reach from 201 to 300. People with heart and lung disease, older adults, and children should avoid all outdoor physical activity. Everyone else should avoid prolonged or heavy outdoor exertion. When the air is hazardous, that is when the AQI is 300 to 500, the entire population is more likely to experience serious health effects and should avoid all outdoor physical activity, remain indoors, and keep activity levels low. Current air conditions can be found at the website sparetheair.com. Farmers and their advocates hope the current lame duck session of Congress will lead to a final agreement on new federal farm legislation. A House Senate Conference Committee has been unable so far to settle on a compromise bill, and the previous bill expired at the end of September. The Farm Bill establishes policies on conservation, research, nutrition, and a variety of other agricultural and food programs. Chad Smith of the American Farm Bureau Federation has more details about the progress of the Farm Bill in Washington.
The American Farm Bureau Federation is optimistic that a new farm bill will be in place by the end of 2018. Andrew Walmsley, AFBF Director of Congressional Relations, says post-election comments by several leaders in both chambers of Congress, including the presumed incoming House Ag Committee Chair, Colin Peterson, are encouraging.
We had to get past the election to figure out a few issues outstanding. When members are back in town next week, all the work that committee staff have done to get us to this point, a few decisions can be made and we can move pretty quickly.
Walmsley says Farm Bureau is hearing that farm bill negotiations are getting close to wrapping up. If negotiators can wrap up the few remaining challenges, Walmsley says there should be no problem passing the bill before the end of the year.
I think they're still kind of working towards some challenges with budget on getting the best bill possible in the commodity title, maybe a few outstanding issues in conservation, and then obviously nutrition. But I think the rest of the bill's pretty close to being wrapped up.
Walmsley says if the farm bill doesn't pass in the lame duck session, waiting until 2019 means they would have to start the farm bill process over, which would be detrimental to agriculture. One thing Farm Bureau representatives are hearing from legislative leaders is that they are not considering a possible farm bill extension.
They are intending to get this done. That's going to be key for farmers and ranchers, our grassroots members, making sure their member of Congress knows how important this is, that they need to be applying pressure to leadership to hopefully have a conference report to vote here in the next couple weeks to get this done.
Chad Smith, Washington.
Despite all the trade uncertainty and disputes during this past year, as far as U.S. agricultural exports are concerned,
it was a good year.
It was a very good year.
Second highest on record.
That's Agriculture Department trade analyst, along with Frank Sinatra, Bryce Cook. We finally got the complete figures for fiscal year 2018, which ended at the end of September. Turns out we sold to other countries $143.4 billion worth of ag products. That's about $600 million less than had been forecast, but
$3.2 billion better than last year, about 3% better.
Now, we bought $127.6 billion worth of food and ag products from other countries, so both exports and imports grew.
But more growth, about 7% growth on the import side compared with 3% on the export side, which meant that the trade surplus decreased, but was still a pretty healthy margin of $15.8 billion.
And Cook says growing imports are not necessarily a bad thing. In fact,
it's a sign of a healthy economy that you have a lot of imports coming in. I mean, currently, some of the major reasons that we have such import growth have to do with the fact that we have a healthy GDP. Unemployment's low. People can afford to buy more products. There's a strong dollar, so goods from abroad are actually cheaper than they would be otherwise. Those are positive things, but they have the effect of shrinking the surplus.
And Cook says we've never had a trade deficit in ag products ever. Back to exports, a mixed bag for U.S. bulk products in FY18.
Soybeans and wheat had lower totals in value and volume terms than 2017. Soybeans was down 9% in value and 5% in volume. Wheat was down 18% in value and 25% in volume. However, corn and cotton actually had better years than expected. Corn actually really made a jump at the end of the fiscal year and was up as a total 17% in value terms and 14% in volume. Cotton also was up a little bit less, 13% in value and 11% in volume terms.
Cook says soybean exports may take another hit in the coming fiscal year. Wheat might do better, though, but we'll get a new official USDA trade forecast for 2019 soon. Cook says he's busy with others right now,
cooking up the new figures.
And they'll be out November 29th. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
Here's this week's California crop report. In the Sacramento Valley, wheat and barley were planted. Sunflower, beans, and rice continue to be harvested in Sutter County. In Tulare County, the cotton harvest continues. Alfalfa was being cut and baled. Table and wine grape harvest is ongoing. Raisin grapes were harvested and laid out for sun drying, while dried raisins were picked up. Asian pears, pomegranates, and quince were harvested. Stone fruit harvest was done for the season. Some old stone fruit orchards were torn out for replacement with newer trees. Persimmon and kiwi are being harvested. Olives, lemons, Valencia oranges, and finger limes are being harvested as well. Navel oranges are being picked and tested for maturity. Pushed-out citrus groves are being prepped for planting. The almond harvest is done for the year. The walnut and pecan harvest continues. Harvested orchards were cleaned. Young trees are being irrigated. In the Sacramento Valley, processing tomatoes continue to be harvested. Brassica and lettuce continues to be harvested over in Monterey County. And we're all still waiting for more rain. Rangeland and non-irrigated pastures remain in poor condition. More precipitation is needed for fall grass germination. Cattle continue to be provided supplemental feed. Take the KSTE Farm Hour with you wherever you go. It's available at KSTE.com or the iHeartRadio app in streaming mode, or you can download it from your favorite third-party podcast aggregator such as iTunes. The California Department of Food and Agriculture has issued draft regulations for industrial hemp cultivation here in California, and it's accepting public comments through December 24th. After the comments are considered, the CDFA will move to finalize the regulations and anticipates that county agricultural commissioners will begin accepting applications and issuing the first licenses for commercial production here in California in 2019. Currently, industrial hemp production is permitted in California only in association with established agricultural research institutions. Public comments can be left at the CDFA website, which is cdfa.ca.gov, and then click on the link labeled Draft Industrial Hemp Cultivation Regulations.
Hemp industry research suggests industrial hemp could provide a multi-billion dollar market for U.S. farmers. Rob Richard, Senior Director for Government Relations, Wisconsin Farm Bureau, says Farm Bureau members pledged support for the legalization of industrial hemp prior to the last farm bill.
They basically took a position to support the marketing, commercialization, the legalization of industrial hemp. The 14th Farm Bill passed provisions that would allow states to set up hemp pilot programs. So that's what we did here in the state of Wisconsin.
Richard says there are many markets available for U.S. farmers.
We are right now, as a country, the largest importer of hemp products in the world. So even though we can't legally grow it in this country except through the pilot program, we're definitely importing it. So we have about a $600 or $700 million market there that American farmers can fill. But as word gets out, as it is marketed more, you're going to see an expansion.
The U.S. hemp market could develop into a $2 to $3 billion industry. Richard says there are many uses for industrial hemp beyond the traditional textiles and rope.
Over the years, the uses of it have really developed and expanded. We're talking hundreds, if not thousands, of uses for this, whether it's in construction, going into the textiles, personal care items, to the high-tech world. Once we get the hemp removed from the Controlled Substance Act, I think it's really going to open up the industry as a whole.
Michael Klimitz, Washington.
The possibility of hemp legalization looms large in the 2018 Farm Bill. And farmers' eyes get big when they hear about the $90,000 per acre that a hemp harvest can bring in just from its oil alone. But Matt Weiser points out in Water Deeply in the May 16th edition that many other businesses could spring forward when hemp gets legalized, including the processing of fiber and the growing of the starter plants.
I imagine at one point in time, America had this kind of equipment because we used to make a lot of things out of hemp, but you know, nearly 100 years have gone by and that equipment doesn't exist in this country anymore. So there's a program in Pennsylvania right now that's being led in part by the National Hemp Association, to create enough of a local crop in hemp to make it sensible to develop this equipment so that the fibers can be processed there. And that's kind of what needs to happen all over the country again. So once we see more acres being planted in hemp, there will be market incentives to start developing the equipment to process the fiber domestically.
Another business I could see developing from this would be for maybe people who run greenhouse operations, and that's culling out the male plant from the female plant, because you mentioned in the article there is a chance the feds might put restrictions that you can only grow the female plant.
Right, and the reason for that is that the hemp and marijuana can cross-pollinate, and your hemp could essentially become marijuana, and you don't want that because you don't want to be restricted by the laws that govern marijuana growing if all you want to do is grow hemp. So in some cases right now, you cannot plant hemp unless you're 5 miles away from the nearest marijuana grower, or you, in addition, you may have to be able to prove that you're only growing male hemp plants, which cannot cross-pollinate. So right now what some people are doing is growing the plants in the greenhouse, and you cannot figure out which plant you have until they reach a certain age. So you grow them in the greenhouse, and then you cull out the ones that you cannot plant. So yes, there could be a market for somebody who does this in the greenhouse and then sells the plant to farmers later on.
Matt Weiser points out that there are more than 25,000 other products that can be made from hemp, given the right processing equipment, including food for people and livestock, fabrics, building materials, ethanol, and biodiesel.
U.S. rice growers will likely see a buildup of stocks and lower prices for this season's crop. The stock buildup coming first, of course, from a 22.5% bigger crop, plus compared to the forecast USDA made a month ago.
We have an increase in imports and a decrease in exports.
USDA Outlook Chairman Seth Meyer. First, imports.
We raised imports to a record 28 million hundredweight, added a million hundredweight this month, and that's on medium short grain into Puerto Rico from China. This has happened before. They've been well-priced into Puerto Rico, and the Puerto Ricans have bought.
And Meyer has cut the U.S. rice export forecast by 2 million hundredweight since last month.
And that's long grain that's been facing tough competition out of South America into Mexico and Central America.
Now, even so, rice exports could still top last year by 10%, but there's that 22% bigger crop, so stocks are going to grow by almost 6%, sending the average all rice price down to $12 a hundredweight, 70 cents less than this past year. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
There are new recruits in the fight against the deadly citrus disease Huanglongbing, HLB, also known as citrus greening disease. Officials released beneficial wasps into citrus trees. The wasps act as natural predators of the Asian citrus psyllid, an insect that can spread that fatal plant disease. More than 3 million of the tiny wasps have been released in Southern California this year as officials work to keep HLB out of commercial citrus groves.
So what is the return of investment for higher education in food and agriculture?
The internal rate of return on investments in this sector, if you look at a median kind of level across all of those studies, something in the order of 65% on investments in these areas.
That offered by University of Nebraska Chancellor Ronnie Green at a recent Farm Foundation forum on the subject. He explains that ROI from another perspective.
Same kind of median estimate for just straight line return on investment in food, agriculture, research and education, natural resources, research and education. Hits a number of about 20 to 1 historically.
And while that return of investment in ag and food research is indeed impressive, Green and others believe future returns in such scientific study will need to exceed the current numbers. This is due to the forecasted challenges that lie ahead. One supporter of ag research, former U.S. Senator from Indiana, Richard Lugar, discusses one of them.
I have always believed that we can develop the technology necessary to grow, store, distribute, and market a safe, affordable, and nutritious supply of food. Even as the number of people on this planet reaches 9.7 billion persons by the year of 2050.
Yet Purdue University Provost and Vice President Jay Eckridge adds it's not just about feeding the world's growing population, but also
ideas like food insecurity are going to take extraordinary human talent to address going forward, and who will provide that talent is a question.
In part because although enrollment in agricultural higher education programs are at near record levels, along with job placements,
fewer students are coming to agriculture from rural backgrounds, and this is just a function of the demographics of our nation. At Purdue, about one-third of our students will come to us with a farm background, and about another 20% with rural non-farm. And so the rest would come from some form of urban, suburban, small town.
And in terms of the land-grant university system and programs like Cooperative Extension, Florida Gulf Coast University President Michael Martin says with fewer students, fewer of the general population with agricultural backgrounds, the way to generate support for farm and food research is not just providing ag education, but providing education about ag.
To understand the value of agriculture when now less than 2% of the population actually has a direct connection, that the connectedness between that and the larger greater good is being lost.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The UC Davis Department of Agricultural and Resource Economics has a wonderful website if you're trying to figure out the exact costs of growing commodities. Beans, grapes, pears, sunflowers, tomatoes, beef, broccoli, cherries, lettuce. The list goes on and on of the amount of studies done on California's crops. Rachel Long is a UC Cooperative Extension farm advisor based in Woodland, and she helps compile some of these reports for crops grown in the Sacramento Valley. And she says it's very helpful for farmers to determine the exact cost of growing certain crops. But more than that, banks look at this data very carefully as well.
Once I was sat next to a woman who actually did these bank loans, and she said, "Oh, are you the ones that put these cost studies together?" And I said, "Yes." And she goes, "Oh, those are just like the Bible for us. We use them extensively for the operating loans for farmers." So we really try to put a lot of effort into this to make sure that that these practices are accurately reflecting the grower inputs and all the costs associated with the production, as well as the returns from the crop yields.
That website at the UC Davis Department of Agricultural and Resource Economics, bookmark this, coststudies.ucdavis.edu. That's coststudies.ucdavis.edu. People in the poultry business say shoppers who want to have fresh California-grown turkey for the holidays should reserve them ahead of time. Whole-body turkeys from California typically become scarce by the end of the holiday season. The California Poultry Federation says the state's turkey production may be slightly larger than last year, but California's farmers produce only about a third of the turkeys that are on the market for the holidays. And there's good news for shoppers heading out to buy that Thanksgiving turkey. Gary Crawford of the USDA has the details.
Well, it's that time again. When many of us are out shopping, getting stuff so we can stuff ourselves for Thanksgiving. Top of the list, that turkey.
Oh, don't that turkey look divine? Yeah. Well, promenade it down the line.
Ah, and the headline this year.
Lots of turkey and lower prices.
Agriculture Department livestock analyst Shay O'Shagham, he says turkey producers have been seeing the year-round demand for turkey meat going down lately, and one possible reason.
We have increased supplies of beef, we have increased supplies of pork, which are competing for the consumer's dollar.
So turkey producers have been cutting production to try to get prices up, and supplies are down from last year by maybe 2%, but the wholesale price drop continues. As we entered November,
the price was about 80 cents a pound, and that compares to about 88 cents a pound last year.
So this year at the supermarket,
a lot of very nice deals, which will help lighten the burden on the wallet as the Thanksgiving meal approaches.
So let's find out about that entire meal cost. Each year, we ask Department of Agriculture economist Anne-Marie Coons to price out the main items for the meal. A meal for four people, serving turkey, sweet potatoes, green beans, cranberries, milk, and bread. So let's start with the honored guest at most Thanksgiving meals, the turkey.
Here I am again. Life of every party.
Life of the party. 20% cheaper life of the party because...
The frozen whole turkey cost $1.07 in 2017, and now it costs 85 cents per pound in 2018.
Or for a 16-pound frozen whole bird, the price? $13.60. That's $3.52 less than last year. Next.
Hot potato, hot potato.
Or actually, sweet potato. 3 pounds, averaging $2.67. $1.29 below last year. Next up.
Green beans.
1 pound, $1.28. That's 59 cents lower than a year ago. Next on the hit parade.
Cranberries.
Now, these may cost us more. A 12-ounce bag this year going for $2.37. That's 22 cents more. Now, let's see, what else?
Got milk?
Oh, yes. A gallon this year, averaging $2.56, 28 cents less than last year. Throw in a pound of bread, that's $1.28, 4 cents less. So, Anne-Marie, putting it all into the machine here, and this year's total cost...
$23.77, compared to last year, that same basket cost $29.27, so a savings of $5.50, or 18.8%.
Ooh, the third year in a row the cost has gone down. That's something to be thankful for, right, Turkey? Yeah, fine. Gary Crawford from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
It's still a specialty crop, but you're more likely to see purple sweet potatoes on the market this year. A company that grows the purple potato says it has increased production steadily the past few years. The sweet potatoes gain their purple color because they're rich in plant pigments that serve as antioxidants with disease-preventing properties. University researchers are working on additional purple varieties that could do well here in California.
Some people who claim to have been in contact with aliens from other planets have described them this way.
Some that are the purple skin with the white flesh.
Ew.
The orange skin, the orange flesh.
Oh, no, that's
worse. And then they have orange skin and white flesh.
Oh, good heavens. But actually, she's talking about...
Sweet potatoes.
Yeah, sweet. Yeah, we're here at the world... Yeah, all right. At the world-famous Veducation Tent at the Agriculture Department's Farmers Market in Washington, D.C. with two veducators, Kayla and Kay. KK, our usual professor. Kayla Johnson and Kay Rensel. She's with the U.S. Sweet Potato Council just in time now for Thanksgiving, which is for many of us the only time that we really partake of sweet potatoes.
But we are trying to drive consumption of sweet potatoes throughout the year.
Partly on the basis of nutrition. Now, Kayla Johnson, you say they are on the list of so-called superfoods. What's in them?
Potassium, phosphorus, calcium, magnesium, vitamin A, and folate.
Says here no fat at all. Lots of fiber. And Kay, you say a medium-sized sweet potato has only 103 calories?
Now, you do have to be careful what all you add.
Yeah, we do add all sorts of things to sweet potatoes. But Kay, you have told us you like sweet potatoes just as they are, right?
And not just because I work for them.
Better say you enjoy. Meanwhile, Kayla, you say sweet potatoes have been used for more than food. In the early 1900s, famous scientist George Washington Carver experimented with them to make what kinds of things?
Some of the notable discoveries included glue for postal stamps, sizing for cotton fabrics.
And we looked online here and found one guy who made this musical instrument out of a sweet potato. Now, Kayla, we are more interested in food uses, of course. So what have you got there?
They're great to add into stir fries, chilies, stews.
And of course,
I'll grab the spoons, you grab the bowl. For that sweet potato casserole.
But I see you and Kay are making something else with folks here. What's cooking there?
We are making honey roasted sweet potatoes. Mm. Very simple. Cut up your sweet potatoes into about 1-inch cubes.
Right.
Toss them in olive oil. Cook them in the oven for about 30 minutes. And then transfer them to a saute pan. Because you're going to toss them with honey, cinnamon, and allspice. And then when you remove them from that pan, you can sprinkle them with a little bit of salt just to have that combination of sweet and salty taste.
Oh, yeah, I love that combination. Now, quickly, sweet potato comedy time. Kayla, you're on.
Why did the sweet potato cross the road?
I don't know. Why?
It saw a fork ahead. It's so bad that it's funny.
I'm not sure about that.
Okay, let's try another one.
No time. Sorry. Not really sorry. For more sweet potato recipes, go online to What's Cooking at USDA. In Washington, Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
One dish that always seems to make it to the table on Thanksgiving is cranberries. And you might be surprised to learn, yes, there are cranberries grown commercially in California. The CDFA says only about 300 acres are dedicated to the production of that crop, however. For more on cranberries, we turn to the USDA's Rod Bain.
The holiday season is just about here. And in many homes, at holiday dinner tables, part of the feast involves some form of cranberries. Then again, cranberries are becoming more of an occurrence in our kitchens and stores and in a variety of ways.
You can add them to smoothies. There's cranberry bread. You can do a cranberry salsa. You can process your cranberries for jams, jellies, and preserves.
As well as cranberry juices, smoothies, and dried snacks, according to USDA Veggiecator Kayla Johnson. And there is some fun, some interesting, and unique aspects about cranberries, from how they are grown to where they are grown, for consideration. I'm Rod Bade. And coming up, some cranberry considerations for your cranium in this edition of Agriculture USA. Now here's an interesting Turkey Day claim, courtesy of Karen Cahill of the Cranberry Marketing Committee.
Of course, we own Thanksgiving. I mean, that's a no-brainer.
Although some, human or fowl, may dispute that. Nevertheless, cranberry is a traditional part of the Thanksgiving Day table. And yes, as USDA Veggiecator Kayla Johnson explains,
it was the Native Americans who introduced cranberries to the early European settlers, who used them in tarts and as a sauce for meats. So that kind of brings us to talking about the association with the pilgrims. The sauce became a significant dish. That's why you typically see the cranberry sauce at traditional American Thanksgiving feasts.
And it was those early European settlers, of German and Dutch origin primarily, that gave cranberries, or what they called craneberries, their name.
Cranberries flower is a pale pinkish color, but the shape almost looks like the head of a sandbill crane. And those were often seen wading through the cranberry bogs.
Now, cranberry consumers can taste some tart in traditional fare like sauces or cranberry juice, but eat a raw cranberry, and Karen Cahill says,
we find that at trade shows a lot of the time we'll have sampling, testing, and they are amazed at the bitterness and the tartness of it. It's on the level as a lemon. And so that is why a lot of the products, like a dry cranberry, has added sugar.
Her job, along with cranberry producers, processors, and marketers across the country, is to promote and expand consumer demand for cranberries and such products beyond the holiday season.
Trying to get people to think about cranberries in a new way, using them outside of cranberry sauce. Let's make barbecue sauce. Let's make salsa with fresh cranberries. Smoothies, using frozen cranberries all year round to buy the fresh cranberries in the fall and throw them in the freezer to use for the whole year. It's just that easy.
And Kayla Johnson says data shows the growing demand for products like cranberry juices and dried cranberries.
Americans consume about 400 million pounds of cranberries per year, and only close to 80 million of those pounds are consumed around the holidays, specifically Thanksgiving week.
Now, going from cranberry consumption to production, there might be some surprises in store for us. For instance, you probably best know about cranberries and cranberry products from the advertisements of that agricultural cooperative based out of Massachusetts.
Hi, we're Ocean Spray Cranberry Growers.
Yet you would be correct in guessing that more than half of the U.S. and world's cranberries are produced in what state?
Hello, Wisconsin!
I think it blows a lot of people away, especially we're headquartered in Massachusetts, and there's a lot of folks in that area that think they have the lockdown on cranberries. But take a trip to Wisconsin and drive around cranberry country for a minute, and you'll see why they produce more than half of the world's cranberries. It's quite a vision.
Meanwhile, Veggiecator Kayla Johnson offers a tidbit that may boggle your mind.
I thought that you had to have a bog for cranberries, but apparently that's not true. You don't need a bog for growing cranberries.
She says cranberry plants can grow in a garden with a 10-by-5-foot plot yielding up to 10 pounds of fresh cranberries. So why then are they grown commercially in bogs?
The reason that they started doing that is for harvesting them. The bog made it a lot easier to do this process they called wet harvesting.
Meaning the natural buoyancy of the berries themselves would be on display when ripe.
And that makes it easier for those harvesting to just go ahead and scoop the ripe ones off the top, and the ones that weren't ripe would sink at the bottom.
Oh, and in terms of production totals of cranberries, Kayla Johnson uses this illustration.
If you strung together all the cranberries in North America, they'd stretch from Boston to Los Angeles more than 565 times.
And with that, we conclude our coast-to-coast considerations of cranberries. This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
More people are moving to rural counties. That's reversing a trend of population decline that began in 2010. That according to a recent report by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The increase in net migration to rural areas coincides with decreased unemployment, rising income levels, and declining poverty. However, the trend toward graying in rural counties continues as they attract retirees but lose new labor force entrants.
An increasing number of U.S. grandparents over the last several years have been placed or are placed in the position of raising a grandchild or grandchildren. In fact, Caroline Krokel of the Agriculture Department's National Institute of Food and Agriculture points out,
we currently have one in 14 children being raised by a grandparent.
And grandparents in this situation face a myriad of challenges, ranging from legal issues, economic hardship, catching up with current-day child-rearing, educational, and social interaction methods, and trauma a child might experience due to separation from a parent or parents, regardless of the reason. One resource available for grandparents raising grandkids is local cooperative extension programs focused on this issue in their local or state service area. Krokel says the Institute provides resources for extension programs in this area.
NIFA provides funding through capacity funds to the extension service, as well as competitive grant programs that could potentially touch on some aspect of grandparents raising grandchildren.
And examples of such extension-based programs are found nationwide. For instance,
West Virginia has a program, Healthy Grand Family, where they look at providing information and resources to grandparents who are raising grandchildren. There are also programs for what we call kinship care, for supports for caregivers of children in out-of-home placement, but with a family member.
And in the Big Sky State, via Montana State University Extension,
we have Montana Grandparents Raising Grandchildren. That's a very successful program that looks at managing the physical and emotional stress of caregiving for grandparents and looks at their well-being and providing research-based resources.
Cornell University Extension has offered a program and curriculum available to Extension and other users
called PASTA, Parenting a Second Time Around, and it provides information and resources, educational classes for grandparents and other related caregivers who are taking on the responsibility of providing for children.
Meanwhile, NIFA competitive grants provide opportunity for study of the dynamics and impacts of grandparents raising grandchildren.
We provide opportunities for researchers to look at these issues. We have extension competitive grants that, like the Rural Health and Safety Education Program, where folks working in extension or in extension and research appointments could apply for funding to look at these issues as well.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The drought that made California thirsty from 2011 to 2016 vastly impacted the bountiful, diverse crops that the Golden State is known for. Almonds, California's number one ag export, was one of many crops that changed its watering ways by being more strategic to keep production going now and in the future.
My name is Raj. I work with my family here at Mina Farms. We're located in south end of Gustine, western Merced County. We grow all trees. We have almonds, walnuts, and cherries are our main crops. We are giving pistachios a try. My family started farming about 20 years ago. After a rough couple years getting started, they kind of got the hang of it. And ever since we've done okay, but definitely these last 5-6 years have been a challenge with the limited resources because, you know, it's commonly known there's three secrets to farming. It's water, water, and water. Without that, nothing you do matters.
That five-year lack of water brought hardships to farms all across California, including Raj's. But that's where UC Cooperative Extension Advisor David Dahl came into play, assisting this family farm.
Almonds being a perennial crop, our stress that we applied to the tree this year impacts not only the crop this year, but also reduces our ability to produce almonds next year. There's many different ways to manage stress within orchards. So when you're looking at the amount of water you have available, strategizing how to apply that through the season is critical. And so we provide some different strategies that should be employed to help manage the stress level within the orchard based on the amount of water that farmers have available within a drought year.
I would say our water management has improved considerably because it had to. I mean, if we didn't do that, we wouldn't still be farming.
Raj also learned a thing or two during the stress of the drought.
Less kind of playing stuff by ear. When you're so regulated in the water that you have to allocate it very carefully. We have spent a lot of money these last few years in soil moisture monitoring, where we can actually look and see exactly how much water is in the soil and available to the trees, because over-irrigating is just not an option anymore.
Raj utilizes various water-saving techniques on his farm, from drip irrigation to using special technology to monitor how much water is currently in each tree.
So this is what's called a nitrogen pressure chamber, more commonly known as a pressure bomb. You pluck them off the tree, and you basically insert the stem of the leaf through this here so you can see the stem poking out in the end. And then what happens is it pressurizes the chamber that the leaf is in with nitrogen. And you look at how many bars of pressure it takes for water to come out of the stem. David actually told us about this nearly a decade ago, and we've been using it nearly as long.
All these practices kind of came into play as farmers managed this drought and probably helped us really bring what we thought we knew through the research that's been developed over the 30 to 40 years and put it into practice on the ground to show that it is effective and it is successful.
You always have to keep adapting and changing and improving, because without that, I mean, you're either getting better or you're getting worse. There's no such thing as staying at the same level anymore, because we got to do what we can to take advantage. And, you know, not to sound like a hippie, but feed the world, you know? I mean, that's what we do out here.
The University of California Agriculture and Natural Resources has more drought tips for growers. Visit their website, ucanr.edu/drought tips, or do an internet search for the title of this, Coping with Drought in Almond Production.
Thanks for listening to the KSTE Farm Hour, heard every Sunday from noon until 1 p.m. Pacific Time, and available anytime as a podcast. Download it at kste.com.